Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've all heard the drumbeat of bad news about food lately. Riots by have-nots in Haiti, Somalia, and Egypt. Soaring food bills for the haves from here to Shanghai. But what if the problem is bigger and here to stay? Author Paul Roberts says it is. He says the wondrous high-tech global food system that spared billions from famine and turned American supermarkets into such a cornucopia carries the seeds of its own destruction. This hour on Point, Paul Roberts on the end of the golden age of food. Joining me today from Toronto is Paul Roberts. He's a journalist who's written for The Washington Post, L.A. Times, and Harper's. His 2004 book, The End of Oil, drew international attention, and today looks pretty prescient. His new book is called The End of Food. It will be in bookstores next week. Paul Roberts, thanks very much for being with us.
Tom, it's a pleasure.
What's the golden age you say we're on the cusp of losing?
Well, I mean, think about, you know, for most of the last century, most of what you heard about the food system was good news. You know, we were able to produce more food more cheaply. It was more convenient. It was safer. It was better, more varied. And it seemed to improve along these courses every year. And I think that sense of, or that expectation of improvement was just sort of built into our culture. It became part of kind of a marker for our larger prosperity. And I think that in the last 2 decades, we've started to reverse course in a number of areas, whether we're talking about, you know, concerns about food safety, you know, pathogens in our meat or contaminated imports from China, whether we're talking about the kind of nutrition we're taking in, you know, the junk food or just the failing nutrient content of some of our produce. When we're talking about food insecurity in places like Africa, we're losing ground, losing a lot of the ground that we'd made up over the last century. And I think the question is, you know, what's causing this and where is it going to lead?
More, better, safer, cheaper became the presumption. And you say the era of that presumption may be ending. Some big thinkers in food and environment are paying attention. Michael Pollan calls your book indispensable. Bill McKibben calls it spellbinding. Then we're reading B. Wilson in The New Yorker. He talks about your book and some others as a second wave of food politics books, taking, B. says, the genre to a new level of apocalyptic foreboding. Are you getting apocalyptic, unnecessarily apocalyptic on us? I mean, you know, as B. cites there, Malthus said centuries ago that human population would always be checked by the failure of food supplies to keep up with population growth and ended up looking kind of ridiculous in the 1960s when the Green Revolution fed everybody, even as we went to many billions in the planet's population.
Well, that's a mouthful there. Yes, absolutely. We've been here before. I mean, humanity seems to run into these crises every century or so or even more frequently, and farmers always respond with technologies, with innovation, with new business methods that have allowed them in the past to overcome these. And the expectation is that we'll continue. And I think that that we'll continue with new technologies, with new business methods. Some new set of tools will allow us to overcome this particular crisis and move on, much as we always have. And I agree that we're already finding a wave of innovations that are improving the way we make food. But we're also facing some constraints that our predecessors never had to deal with. So let's consider, first of all, consider the way that demand is growing today. Mm. It's, you know, it's not just that we're going to have more people, around 3 billion more people. It's that most of those people will be in the developing world, primarily Asia. And the developing world is still catching up with Western dietary practices, primarily our great intake of meat. Mm. And meat is important because it takes it's very resource intensive. It takes a lot of grain to make a pound of meat. It takes on average 8 pounds of grain to make a single pound of meat, which means that you know, if we're going to double our meat intake globally, which is the expectation over the next 3 decades, we're going to need an extra billion tons of grain, which is about half again what we're producing today. And we really don't know where all that grain is going to be grown. You know, kind of the traditional methods for increasing your output were you went and plowed up more acres. That's harder to do. Today, most of the readily arable, you know, farmland is already growing farm crops. And much of what remains is doing other things, like growing forests. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Brazil is a really good case in point here. It's positioning itself as the new agricultural powerhouse of the 21st century. But it's doing so almost entirely at the expense of its rainforest. So there are costs to expanding the old-fashioned way. More recently, we expanded by getting more bushels per acre. And we did that with, mm-hmm. you know, irrigation, fertilizers, et cetera. But here again, we're running into constraints. We could start with energy. You know, you need a lot of energy to grow food. You got to run your tractors. You've got to truck the food from the farm to the factory and then to the grocery store. And this is a food system that was designed for oil at $15 to $20 a barrel. And the idea that oil is going to be probably considerably higher than $130 a barrel really raises questions about the sustainability of this system.
Paul, what are you predicting here then? You say as we add another 3 billion, let's say as the planet's population goes from 6 or 6.5 to 9 and 9.5 billion, are you predicting that people will simply have to forego that sirloin steak in favor of a grain-heavy diet, or are you predicting famine?
Well, I'm predicting the former. I think that, you know, as prices of food continue to rise, particularly for meat, as we sort of begin to express the true cost of meat, what it really costs to raise a cow or a pig or a chicken, I think that price effect is going to dampen demand, particularly in wealthy countries like the United States, you know, Canada, Europe. We all have per capita meat intakes that are well above the global average, not just above the global average, but well above what most people think the globe can sustain per capita. So I think that we're going to see just a sort of a transformation, almost a regression in global diets, which won't be painless, because we've become accustomed to the idea that if you were wealthy enough to afford meat, you could have it, and it was sort of an index of your own individual prosperity. It's what people do as their incomes rise; they eat more meat. And the idea that we're going to have to, you know, put a cap on that somehow, I think it isn't going to go over well. It certainly isn't going to go over well in an election year in a country like the United States.
In the pages of your book, The End of Food, you paint a picture of the current global food system, I guess we could call it, as kind of a big, mighty engine starting to blow apart, kind of a system failure. What are some of the symptoms and dynamics you're pointing to there?
Well, I think, you know, we have built a mighty engine, and it's sort of what humans do. We come up with systems to provide the most calories for the least cost. You know, it's optimal foraging strategy. It's what all animals do. But we've been particularly good at it, especially when we moved from hunting and gathering to agriculture, and we began sort of rationalizing the system for producing food. And the idea was, you know, you want to produce as many calories as you possibly can for the least expended effort. And you know, to a certain point, that's worked wonderfully. It's what has allowed us to survive this long, and not just survive but thrive. But I think what one can argue is that there you reach a point of diminishing returns where you're trying to cut costs so dramatically that you begin taking risks. You could point to our move into countries like China to import raw ingredients from China as a classic example. I mean, you know, why the rationale for going there isn't mysterious at all. You have food producers who are under huge pressure from retailers. You know, a retailer like Walmart has so much market share that it can essentially dictate to its suppliers, here's the kind of products you will sell us, and here's the price that you will sell them for.
One-fifth of American groceries, I think you report, moving through Walmart.
And that figure will likely grow. So these suppliers, you know, the Krafts and Nestle's and Tyson's of the world are under intense pressure to drive their prices down. And a producer like Tyson, this is the big poultry, actually it's a big meat, you know, producer now, a protein company, is how they describe themselves. They're under such intense profit pressure, they average 2.5 cents of profit per pound of chicken that they sell. And that margin has been pretty stable for the last decade, which means they're not making very much money at all. And the only way, if your profit per, which essentially they're making a nickel, a little over a nickel per bird. And if that's what your return is per bird, the only way to increase your return is to do what? You know, raise more birds, pump more birds through the system. And you also, you want to look for cheaper ingredients, cheaper feed to feed your animals. If you're a food, you know, if you're a company like Nestle's, you want a cheaper raw ingredients like corn and wheat, dairy products to turn into your finished products. So you have to search the world to find the low-cost suppliers. And that is how we ended up in China. And you know, here's a country, China, which is infamous for producing, you know, low-quality toys, consumer electronics, clothing, and yet somehow we thought it would be okay to have them produce our food for us. You know, China is, in terms of its food, is really where the United States was about a century ago when Sinclair wrote The Jungle. You know, it's a country that's rapidly expanding its food system but doesn't have the regulatory authority to keep it safe.
And yet we're reaching out because of the system we're in, and Paul Roberts says that system may be breaking down. His new book is The End of Food. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about warnings of big trouble in our global food system, warnings that a golden age of cheap and plentiful food is ending, that the system we have is going off the rails. Paul Roberts joins us from Toronto, Canada. His new book is The End of Food. It's out next week. Paul, I don't know if you can, I mean, how do you connect this to the headlines we've been seeing in recent months? You know, food riots all over the place, rationing in some countries, spikes in prices all over the place. The headline on CNN.com today is Red Cross Raises Specter of Food Wars. How do you relate the news of these recent months to the long-term trend you're talking about here? And is there a direct relationship?
Well, I think there is, but I think you're correct to suggest sort of a two-frame reference here. One is short-term and one is on a longer term. In the near term, you can point to things like our biofuels policy, that is the policy of turning you know, feedstock, feed grains into fuel. That's certainly a major factor, a major change that's really putting the food system under pressure. You've also got some sort of natural occurrences, drought in Australia. You have a poor crop, poor grain crop in Canada. And these are sort of adding up to prices, price pressure that really wasn't anticipated. And again, what that does, I think, is it allows us to focus on short-term culprits. Biofuels is the favorite. It clearly was a mistake, I think, to believe that we could kind of get ourselves out of our oil crisis by turning food into fuel. The logic there seems to be that we would replace our dependence on one finite commodity, oil, with another finite commodity, acres. So clearly there's a problem there. But as problematic as biofuels are, it sort of allows us to focus on that and not look at these longer-term trends, which are, as we talked about, population, changing diets in the developing world, and constrained resources. You know, look at fertilizers. 40% of the food we produce today, 40% of the calories, is the direct result of the fact that we have cheap nitrogen fertilizer. And nitrogen fertilizer comes from natural gas. And natural gas, as we now know, is as constrained as oil is. And so the idea that we're going to have to go through the next 50 years and another 4 billion people with nitrogen fertilizer prices, you know, 4 to 5 times above historic trend lines is breathtaking. You know, how are we going to do that? And that's not – but that isn't the story that people are focusing on. They're just pointing their fingers at biofuel. So, again, we've got a kind of a disconnect between things that are going on right now and sort of what those what the crisis sort of hints at in the longer term.
And let me ask you on that long term. I grew up, like most of our listeners, in the heart of that golden age you talk about. Grew up on a grain farm. I remember jumping into huge wagons and trucks full of brimming with corn and beans, and farmers marveling year after year at how their yields were growing. And everything seemed, it was just going like gangbusters and would forever. But now I read you making a couple of arguments here, and one is a quality argument. The other is a quantity argument. You've got real complaints about the quality of the food that we've seen emerge from that superabundance. So is it ultimately a quality question or a quantity question? Will it be enough to eat or just not what you'd want to eat?
I think it's going to be both. I mean, if you look at the transition in the beef industry from sort of a grass-fed, where all cattle were raised on grass, to an industry where most cattle are finished up in feedlots on a corn diet, if you look at what that's done to the quality of the meat, this is a meat that's now its fat content is higher, and its ratio of good fatty acids to bad fatty acids has changed substantially. So we've altered the quality of the meat. People are now accustomed to the taste of a corn-fed steak, so that's what they want. But in terms of the quality of the food, the nutritional value, that has declined. And, the benefits of raising on corn, fattening an animal on corn are clear. You can cut the time in half. You can get it to slaughter weight in half the time, and the animal is bigger. So, I mean, it makes sense from a purely economic standpoint. But in terms of the quality of the product that you're, handing your consumer, it's hurting it. And then you sort of back up and say, well, what else goes on? Well, you're raising these animals in these huge feedlots, and you have this astounding manure problems, water quality problems. The air quality around those facilities is appalling. Then you have the nitrogen that was carried into the animal through the corn, and now out the other end of the animal is now leaching into the water supply. So to improve the economics of the operation, you've imposed all these other external costs that we're now paying for and will continue to have to pay for. And if we want to reform this system, we're going to have to take those external costs into account. And when we do, what we're left with is the prospect of paying much more for our meat.
And when, one question here is, who's we? Are you talking affluent nations, the affluent populations within nations? And when they're paying more for meat and presumably everything else, are you predicting people will still be able to fill the cupboards if they've got money, but others won't? Is starvation a piece of what you foresee in the end of food?
Well, I mean, there's sort of the perfect world where we could figure out, here's what the globe can sustain. Here's what it can withstand in terms of food production. Here's how much meat we all could eat on a global per capita basis that would be sustainable and equitable. In other words, we'd all get a share. Now, what's likely going to happen is wealthy nations will be able to afford to eat more of the foods they like, and that will leave the less wealthy to eat less. And we're sort of accustomed to thinking of those wealthy nations as maybe Japan and Europe and the United States. But, in truth, China is now emerging as a hungry new player on this market. And China now, with its massive export business, has the wealth now to buy the food off half the tables of the world. It is now become this huge new consumer of grain. And it's one of the biggest problems for countries in Africa. Poor consumers in Africa are now competing with increasingly rich consumers in China for grain. So, this wasn't really how we anticipated, this transformation of our food system going along. We sort of imagined that we'd continue to get these great increases in yield that you were talking about, where farmers would grow more bushels for, every acre every year. And instead, what we're seeing is sort of the same old pattern is emerging, where the wealthy will have and the less wealthy won't.
Paul Roberts' new book out next week is The End of Food. Paul, let's turn to our listeners. Nancy's calling from Revere, Massachusetts. Hi, Nancy. You're on the air with Paul Roberts.
Hi, Paul. Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the psychological and sociological implications about the end of food. I was working in Moscow in 1990 during the waning days of the Soviet Union, and there was very little food to be had. During the 5 weeks that I was working there, I lost over 10 pounds just because there wasn't anything to eat. In the grocery stores, but, you know, they're not like supermarkets. They're little grocery stores, really, just had paper bows on their shelves so that their shelves wouldn't be empty, but their shelves were empty. When the group that I was working with came back to Boston on the second half of this cultural exchange after my 5 weeks there, we brought them down to Faneuil Hall Marketplace, which listeners from the rest of the country may not recognize, but it's a large emporium of food and shopping, and
all the fancy food you'd ever want to see.
Exactly. And our Russian friends were so overwhelmed by the plenty there.
But Nancy, what's the lesson you draw from that? Russia, the Soviet Union sort of was famously inefficient in agriculture. Are we immune from that, or are you fearing empty shelves?
I think that we are in la-la land, as you intimated before. Our Russian friends were virtually catatonic down at Spaniel Hall, and we had to get them out of there. They just couldn't function, literally. It was too much for them to take. And I do think that we have, you know, even when I came home after 5 weeks to go to the Stop and Shop, I couldn't take it. I was just overwhelmed after having lived with nothing for those 5 weeks.
Nancy, so, let's hear Paul on your observation, if we may. Paul, how about it? Are we going to look back on photographs of American supermarket shelves circa, you know, 1995 in 20 years from now and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe they had that abundance? Or does the party go on?
Well, you know, there's a couple of points I think you can draw from there. The first is that, you know, we have to remind ourselves again and again how absolutely serious this is in places that don't have this, you know, automatic abundance. I mean, we have seen food riots for the first time in a long time. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Lebanon nearly fell into a renewed civil war, and the spark that led to that confrontation in the street was a protest over food and fuel prices. We've seen that kind of political instability emerging, you know, flashpoints all over the globe directly the result of these high food costs. So let's remind ourselves that food is a thing that, you know, that citizens absolutely will not tolerate doing without. They can't. So that's sort of the starting point. In terms of America's abundance, this was almost as powerful a sort of an ideological weapon as anything in our nuclear arsenal. Recall that Khrushchev was intentionally shown these bulging supermarkets just to show the Soviets where the American muscle lay. It wasn't just in its military hardware; it was its agricultural prowess as well. But what's interesting is Nancy's point about the facade that the Russians were putting in the grocery stores to keep the impression of bounty.
Paper bows on the shelves.
Right. There's a facade about ours as well. You know, we have this just-in-time, this very lean just-in-time inventory system, delivery system, because no one wants to pay to hold inventory of any food. So they want to stock the shelves just as they need, as they're emptied. And, you know, this is the Walmart model. And it saves a lot of money, and it keeps things fresh, but it doesn't have a lot of slack in the system. So as we saw when Katrina swept through, you know, supermarket shelves were emptied in a matter of days, and it took a long time for that food to be replenished. So you're asking yourself, so the system is clearly more vulnerable to disruption. It doesn't have that margin for error that it used to. And I think this is something that we don't have to run out of food to see the effects of a disruption on an inventory system that's become this lean.
But there's a system behind those shelves that has kept them full year after year after year after year. Are you saying that something going on in the American breadbasket, you know, shy of a hurricane-style catastrophe, something in the system itself is going to be putting less out there? Or, you know, for most consumers, on it goes.
Well, I think both. I mean, first of all, you look at the part of the system that's close to us. That inventory system is so lean now that it's at risk of disruption. Then you go further back up the system. You say, all right, the producers of all these products, where are they getting their grains? They're now competing to get their grains from they're competing with makers of biofuel. They're competing with China. That competition is driving the price up. So food companies are asking, well, we'll have to pass those costs on to our consumers. But they're also asking, what do we do 5 years from now? Are we going to continue to be able to sell, you know, Cheetos in these enormous bags for this at this, you know, terribly low price? Or are we going to have to rethink our model, our two-for-one family-sized, you know, model, which has really become the dominant way of selling food in this country? Is that going to have to change? And then going further back into the system, up to the very farms themselves, how is a farm going to, you know, continue to produce more and more food each year when that increase in bounty was, again, dependent on being able to apply cheap fertilizers and have access to unlimited irrigation water?
Paul Roberts' new book is The End of Oil. Let's get a call from John in Taunton, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to call and say I'm a grocery store merchandiser.
Okay.
So I set product inside of a local supermarket chain.
Yeah.
Speaking to the idea that there's somewhat of a facade in the amount of food we have on the shelf, right now in my chain, we're duplicating a lot of product in our shelf space, which basically means, like, you can have a 24-foot salad oil set that could be shrunk to 12 or 16 feet, but there's a lot of duplication, which they're saying is for cost cutting, so that the average price comes down. Anything that didn't give a great price may have been rejected.
Okay.
From the shelf space. So I'm wondering, is it supply issue? Is it just cost cutting? And basically, what happens when we do have an availability of product? Is it going to blow these giant holes?
But John, I want to understand what you're saying. Do you feel some shortage or, you know, diminution in the supply of products there? Or are you saying you've got more to offer?
There's less selection, definitely. My personal feeling is that the supply is being reduced. And if we ever were in, like, kind of a crisis scenario, we easily could see large holes on our shelves while this is going on. Because it will affect, say, multiple shelves in the same set. The same product is on two shelves right over it, or three shelves in this giant block of product. So if that one product becomes unavailable, you might get a 2-foot by 3-foot hole in your merchandising space.
Paul Roberts, you hear John? He's the supermarket merchandiser, and he fears, you know, chunks being blown right out of those shelves if there's a disruption.
It's news from the front line.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, think about what he's saying. I mean, that goes to the sort of the unsustainability of the retail model. You know, if you look at supermarkets over the past 30 years, they've become enormous. And part of it is they wanted to, you know, attract more consumers. They wanted to have wider aisles so you felt more comfortable there with your bigger shopper, you know, shopping cart. Mm-hmm. But they also wanted to have more shelf space for more products because the more variety that consumers are presented with, the more purchases they make. So supermarkets have the number of SKUs, you know, the number of stock-keeping units that supermarkets keep has gone up substantially from, I believe it was around 10,000. It grows by up 10,000 a year. And so what that means is you get this bewildering variety when you go to the store, and that's one of the things that probably won't, as John is pointing out, probably won't be sustainable if food prices continue to go up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Paul Roberts wrote The End of Oil, and we've seen what's up there. Now he's written The End of Food. It's out next week. Makes you wonder about what's going to be on the supermarket shelves in this country and around the world. He joins us today from Toronto. We're going to talk about solutions in this segment, and here in a moment from a young man who's looking at putting vegetables on the tops of our buildings, maybe on tops of our supermarkets. But let's take some calls first. Tanya, Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Tanya, you're on the air with Paul Roberts.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I usually shop at Whole Foods, and I love my grocery store a lot. But sometimes I go in there, and there's like a huge, huge display of something like clementine, like a giant wall of clementine.
Right. All those boxes stacked.
And it makes me wonder, like, does that make more people buy so that food is then used? Or when things are stocked in excess like that,
does that food go to waste?
Paul, what do you say? Are we going to see those walls of you name it? Because it's a great marketing thing. Get you excited. You want to buy clementines. Is that the future? Or are we going to see three boxes and I don't know what?
Well, that's certainly been the model. I mean, those displays are there to do exactly what she says. It's to sort of make you think, wow, that looks pretty. I want some. You know, the whole produce section is really a model, kind of the jeweler's model of food. Those displays are set up with perfectly, you know, colored, perfectly uniform fruits and vegetables to keep that appearance. Supermarkets tend to throw away huge amounts of produce. A lot of it never even leaves the farm, or you know, the buyers reject large fractions of it. So the system is wasteful primarily to allow grocers to maintain this appearance of not just abundance but beauty. You know, food is sort of a fetish. So that is certainly one thing that would be harder and harder to maintain as food prices go up. And I think you're going to see that. I think you're going to see the variety, the huge variety that we have today. I think that's probably going to shrink somewhat. You know, and we've been focusing on just maintaining the system in terms of volume, but, you know, consider some of the other concerns we have about this food system and the whole issue of safety. You know, food safety, the pathogen load in the meat stream has been coming back up again after declining for decades. And, you know, that, again, is a result of, you know, this sort of factory model that we've adopted, a factory model that was designed to produce meat cheaply and to give us that uniform, attractive meat that would, you know, appeal to consumers without reminding them that the meat actually came from an animal.
Meat stream, not to mention the spinach stream, where we saw the problems not so long ago. Tanya, when you go into Whole Foods, which has that splendid variety, high-priced, stuff comes from all over the world, do you look at that and feel confident that's going to be there, you know, for the foreseeable future? Or does it look like, a demonstration of a golden age that may not last?
You know, to me, the reason I think about that whenever this topic comes up is because it really just makes me nervous. Like, I don't like to see, I feel like that's excess, and I don't like to see food potentially going to waste like that. I think of all the starving people, it just, yeah, I'm compelled to buy them, but I don't think that's how we ought to be stocking our grocery stores.
Yeah, Tanya, thanks for your call. And yet there's so much innovation that has gone into food production, and one can only imagine we'll continue to go into food production. Paul, I want to talk about solutions, but I've got a guy with me right now who may be on to one. Keith Agoda joins me in the studio. He's founder and president of Sky Vegetables. They're committed to urban farming. Their plan is to build and run commercial and sustainable greenhouses on the rooftops of supermarkets in the United States and maybe one day around the world, with the harvest then taken downstairs and sold right on site. His plan for gardens on supermarket rooftops won first prize, $10,000, in the G. Stephen Burrell Innovation Business Plan Competition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he just graduated. I've known Keith for a long time. Thanks for coming in, Keith.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So have you got a little solution that goes supermarket by supermarket, or is it ultimately a big supermarket? Can we, you know, forget about transporting it with mega gallons of diesel fuel and grow it upstairs and bring it downstairs? Is this an ornament or a solution?
I personally think it's a solution. And the reason is because, you know, if you farm at the point of consumption, at the point of sale, it reduces, you know, a lot of the problems in terms of the oil costs and the pollution.
But how much garden can you put on a rooftop? You're going to have trucks dumping, soil up on the top of the supermarket? How much weight can it take? How much can you produce up there?
Right. Well, actually, we plan on using hydroponics, which is much lighter weight, and it has a much higher yield. And it's funny because in the United States, hydroponics is kind of foreign. But in countries such as Australia, New Zealand, Holland, Spain, when you say you're a farmer, people just assume you're a hydroponics farmer.
But a lot of people buy hydroponic tomatoes and the rest in this country. It's not so totally unfamiliar. Yet how much can you do up there? You started this off in Madison, Wisconsin, long cold winters. What can you grow on the rooftop, you know, in January in Madison?
Well, fortunately, the technology already exists to have, you know, year-round production. And the way you do this is with insulated greenhouses, and then using solar energy, rainwater harvesting, and sourcing the heat from downstairs at the supermarket, and you're able to create a sustainable system that can operate year-round and produce all different types of fruits, vegetables, herbs, even fresh-cut flowers.
Paul Roberts, what do you think? Is this an example of the kind of human ingenuity that will be brought to bear on the problem you described to solve it?
It is. I think I applaud it. I mean, this is exactly that. It's an illustration of sort of an innovation that is targeted toward the new reality, not the old one. The old reality was, the food market was to be dominated by large-scale, low-cost players. The new reality is, it's going to be cost prohibitive to bring, our vegetables in from Chile. So what are we going to do? Well, let's produce it locally. And the emphasis on local production is critical. And I think also the emphasis on making visible the farmers, once again.
Right upstairs.
Letting consumers see, there's people that make this food is critical, because we've really done a good job of putting our food production in the closet, so to speak, and it's time for it to come out.
Keith, the supermarket guys you talk with, though, they are part of a great big industrial food system. What's your reaction from them? Are they interested, or are they like, get out of town? We get our tomatoes from Florida. Who wants the hassle of a greenhouse on the roof?
Well, I think it's a mixture of both, at this point at least. And I think people will come to realize that the closer you farm to the point of sale and point of consumption, the more nutritious, the more safe the food will be, the better tasting, fresher, and it has all these qualities which I think people want and they need. And I think supermarkets will come to realize this as well.
Supermarkets with greenhouses right on the roof, and down they come. What percentage of a vegetable aisle might be stocked hypothetically from a greenhouse on the roof? Are we talking 5% here?
I think it depends on the size of the supermarket and the size of the rooftop. So it's going to vary, but I think a large portion of the produce that a supermarket can sell could potentially come from the rooftops or even surrounding rooftops in the local area and then transported, a few blocks to the supermarket as well.
Is that going to be appetizing because it's local or not appetizing because it's upstairs in the parking lot?
Well, perhaps both at this front as well. But the quality of the produce will be as good, if not better, as any other produce produced anywhere.
Paul Roberts, pull the curtain on back then for us here. When you look at solutions, I mean, maybe here's one, kind of ingenious, put a garden on the roof. But I can't help feeling some skepticism about the portion of the overall solution that might represent. There's a lot of people to feed, a lot of hungry mouths out there. Where do you see solutions lying, Paul?
Well, I guess you raise a good point. I mean, it's going to be hard to sort of replace the global sourcing system that we have today with a network of rooftop gardens. But that's not what Keith's proposing. I think what he's suggesting is that we move incrementally into
right.
this.
Supplement.
That, Right, and that you begin filling in at the margins, and you introduce consumers to this, both a new kind of produce and a new idea for how it should be grown. You introduce the system, the distribution, the retailers to the idea, and you gradually bring it online. I think but stepping back and say, okay, so local isn't going to fix this thing all by itself. It's not big enough. But there is, in the same way, there's not a single solution for this problem. It's a series of problems, and it's going to require a series of solutions. One of those is going to be a greater emphasis on local and regional. So how do we get more local and regional? I've heard some people suggest subsidies for smaller farmers instead of subsidies for large farmers. I think what you really want to do is prime the pump in terms of demand, and already we're seeing local governments, schools, state governments beginning to consider the idea of sourcing, that is buying their food, only from local or regional producers. New York is considering the school system in New York, which is one of the largest sort of public cafeterias outside of the Pentagon, is considering just buying its food from regional producers. That demand would be so massive it would be far greater than that regional food system could supply at first. But with that kind of assured demand, you can be certain that producers would come back online. And with those kinds of demand centers appearing all over the country, you could really sort of recapture or reshape the food system to much more of a local emphasis. But let's not fool ourselves to imagine that this is going to be a world of small farmers and local production, because we've kind of passed that point. There's too many people on the planet, and too many of them live in places that can't provide their own food. Places like Africa, China and India,
they're both in severe water shortage, and they're going to require imports from places like us. So the food system of the future, even a sustainable one, is going to be a hybrid, and it's we're going to have to start thinking along those lines of a sort of a hybrid solution, and not get too caught up on one solution or another. Or we're going to be spinning our wheels.
It doesn't get more local than upstairs or the backyard garden, but that may not be enough. Let's take a call from Charlottesville, Virginia, and Deborah. Hi, Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes. Yeah.
There are a few issues I wanted to address. One is this idea of abundance in America, and the other is the idea of having to feed grain to cattle in order to create beef. I mean, that's kind of a myth. Grass-fed beef is a lot healthier, and it takes the burden off of trying to supply grain in order to raise cattle. Cattle were meant to.
And yet, you know why farmers do that? As Paul says, it fattens the beef up very quickly, and consumers have become accustomed to that grain-fed beef.
That's true, mm-hmm. But there's a whole movement of consumers out here who are demanding grass-fed
mm-hmm.
beef. Which brings me to the next point. One of the recent points Mr. Roberts made was this idea of demand. Well, the fact is that there is a huge demand for local food, and the problem is not the availability of the food. The problem is the farmers being inhibited from providing it to the consumers who want it because of regulatory inhibition. Now, I know this raises issues for people, concerns about safety, but we have seen what has happened in the industrial model and the million-pound recalls of beef. The fact is the industrial model is dying, and to ask the question, is the end of the industrial model going to mean starvation? The answer is no, of course not, because we still have abundant agricultural resources.
Deborah, are you suggesting, you know, backyard chickens, backyard beef lots, or, you know, I'm only slightly facetious, more local in that way?
It's a facetious question, but it's an absolutely serious question.
Mm-hmm.
I am the executive director of the National Independent Consumers and Farmers Association. We have state affiliates across the country, and our mission is to restore unregulated free trade between farmer and consumer. In Virginia, we've had a recent victory in the General Assembly of partially restoring that. People in Virginia can now bake in their home kitchens baked goods, pastries, jams, jellies without being inspected and sell them directly to the final consumer. What we want is a complete restoration of what was normal transactions between farmer and community forever until fairly recently when the industrial regulations were imposed on the local farmer and consumer.
So free the people to raise their food, sell their food, buy the food as they like it. We thought that all those regulations were going to make us safer, and then what we've seen in beef lots and spinach lots, it ain't necessarily so. Deborah, thanks for that. Keith Agota with Sky Vegetables, do you run into regulatory problems when it comes into sort of new sources of production here up on the roof? Do the, do the food regulators, are they happy with the growing tomatoes on the roof or not?
Well, to first answer it, it's considered a green roof since we're going to have plants on the roof. And green roofs in the United States are just growing in popularity and booming in cities like Chicago, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., even Boston, it's starting to really sprout out.
So you're not running into regulatory prohibitions on it?
Well, a little bit. And we figure with some good lawyers and the help of the state of Wisconsin and local governments that we're going to be able to overcome this.
Paul Roberts, do you see a change in law in Deborah's pointing to, you know, a lot more trade between individuals than we've been accustomed to in our industrial age. Will that be part of the tapestry of answers that you foresee?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as consumers begin demanding different kinds of food and food that's produced in different ways, and as global sources begin to really struggle, you know, it's going to get harder and harder to fly produce in from Mexico and Chile. It just is. So as that dynamic sets in, new systems are going to emerge, or I should say reemerge, because, you know, this country had a pretty robust farm-to-market system, even 50 years ago. Throughout the East Coast, you see all these farm-to-market roads, mm-hmm. and that was how food moved from the farms into the markets. A lot of that's been torn up. A lot of it's been turned into, you know, running trails, and a lot of the networks are gone. A lot of the small-scale distributors are gone. They could be rebuilt, but there's a regulatory set of hurdles to overcome, but there's also just the infrastructure. It's got to be rebuilt, and we have to ask, you know, what is it that we're trying to build here? Are we going to, you know, how local can we go? what kind of regional, local balances are going to have to be. But the fact that we're having this conversation and asking these questions, I think, is a really encouraging sign, because 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we wouldn't even be talking like this. We'd be simply marveling at the fact that we could get a box of salad greens from Costco, you know, for $4.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really care where the salad greens came from or what was required to make them. And I think now we're starting to ask those questions, and that's a really encouraging sign.
And now we may be growing those vegetables right up on the roof. Keith Agota has been with us right out of Madison, Wisconsin, with Sky Vegetables, president and founder there. Keith, good luck with it. We hope it works out. We look forward to that tomato that rolls downstairs.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
And Paul Roberts, thanks for all the new insights. Thanks for the new book, The End of Food, out next week. Joining us there from Toronto after a red eye from California. We appreciate it, Paul. Thanks very much
for joining us.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.